put an outline on the board this morning, just so that you know that there always is an outline. You might lose it in the talk, but there is one. This one will have 5 parts, and that's there for me as much as for you. Okay. It's the first one says, Junie, I'm going to tell you about a member of my congregation whom we call Junie. The second one says, the problem. I will identify both Junie's problem and a problem that seems to be much more general than Junie's. And that will be a setup. I'm setting you up with that because we need to come back to that problem near the end. The third says, the solution of the faithful, and I mean during the biblical era, Old Testament and New Testament, how they handled such a problem. The fourth says, that solution applied also by us, and I'll try to bring it down to present day. And all of that is a preparation for Junie's story, the story that I would tell Junie based upon Scripture. In fact, since I'm pretty sure the tape has begun to run, the title of this lecture is Scripture the Script. Yesterday, we spoke of general principles of what takes place in the event of storytelling. I gave you an example of a non-scriptural story, one that I told my daughter, and I told it to you so that we could perhaps feel or experience as much as understand that the telling of a story does more than explain, but it also embraces the individual that needs explanation and so forth. I'm going to hope that you can carry those principles from yesterday into today. I want to build on yesterday. I want to build on that community or that sense of solution that we established when we told a story. Remember that I took some of the specific events and characteristics out of my daughter's life, wove them into a story so that a story could go back and help her through those events, okay? The one baby step that I want to take today is to say that now you don't have to make up such stories. We don't have to make them up. They don't have to be fantasy or fiction, but they may be found in Scripture. That those stories themselves may be the true stories of Scripture and perform exactly the same function, but even more, even better, even more powerful since they become God's story. That's my thesis. All right, let me begin by telling you about Junie. See if I can get you to see this fellow, and then that will make concrete our topic today, I hope. I'm still trying to learn how to live with this hood. I put chairs on the sides over there and left a blank space so that most people would be able to see. Junie is a young adult. He's a member of Grace, Inner City Parish, where I am the pastor, have been for a while. I used to see Junie every once in a while, almost never at worship. I think I did see him at worship once. But his family has been a long time. They call him Junie because his name is Melvin. Well, his dad's name is Melvin, too. And at least in our area, it's habitual to call the son who has the same name as the father, Junior. And Junior becomes Junie over a period of time. That's why they call him Junie. Junie is taller than I am, very dark-skinned, a beautiful dark skin. It seems to have tones in it, like you see into it. Arresting eyes Junie has. Large, dark brown eyes that will look at you not so much as though they are resting on you, but as though they are leaning on you, those eyes. That's the one thing that I always recognized about Junie. I used to go visit his mother, who also didn't attend church. Her name was Lola, and generally she told me why she didn't. The reason she didn't attend church is because she didn't have any teeth yet. She kept waiting for her teeth to come in. As soon as that she got her new teeth, she'd come to church. So I'd visit her, and Junie would pass through the living room, and I would see him every once in a while, and I'd be particularly struck by his eyes. Before I got to know him, I had heard of him, little bits and pieces. He had been in the Navy. He had been discharged honorably, tried his hand at just plain old living in Evansville, and felt a failure at it, so he re-upped in the Navy,
Only this time he didn't last but a year and a half, and he was put into the brig for a minor infraction. Finally, he was discharged again, and they said honorable, but I think that there's a code on the discharge which sometimes implies that it isn't altogether honorable, that, or at least that it wasn't without complication. So when Junie came back to Evansville once again and tried in desultory fashion to find a job, which is to say, you must understand this, to try to find a purpose in his life, to get over this transition of being child, adolescent, young, adult, and to become independent and purposeful and know where he's going, he failed. He didn't find a job very well. He'd been a cook in the Navy, so he tried that, and that just didn't work. He couldn't maintain it. And although I wasn't close to him at the time, it was as though you pick up something that looks as though it's going to be solid, and it's your life. But when you squeeze it, or you want to trust it, it begins to fall to dust in your hands, and that can be devastating. Junie did drugs some, I'm sure, and then he went to jail. If I remember right, there were two crimes he committed. It was the second one that put him into jail, and he didn't deny that he was responsible. He and a friend of his, and I believe that they were high at the time, rolled a man downtown in Evansville, jumped him and knocked him over and took his money and so forth. And so I went to see Junie in jail, which is part of my ministry, that I go to jail every once in a while, and I see people there, except that when I saw Junie, it was different from other times. Usually when I come, I'll sit out and we'll meet in a wicker, it's not really a cell even, it's like you walk into a basket with two compartments made out of chicken wire or made out of hurricane fencing, and between you is that wire, and you sit and you talk, but you're both locked in on two different sides. Well, when I went to see Junie, the guards were kinder than usual. It's arbitrary, by the way, when you're in jail. Part of the problem of being in jail is that you depend upon the whim of other human beings. And if they're in a good mood on a certain day, it can be a good day for you. If they're in a lousy mood, they'll bring all the laws down on you and make it difficult for you to live. You can ask for the most common thing and not get it. There were times when I go to jail and I have a book and they allow me to give it to the person I'm talking to. There are other times when they say, no books, no, not at all. Doesn't matter what it is, Bible or whatever. So it's hard to go. But this time when I came to see Junie, they were solicitous of me. They said, one guy who took me to the back said, I don't know what to do with him. He doesn't talk. Junie doesn't talk. They said, Melvin doesn't talk. So we went all the way back through that labyrinth and came to the place where they have the holding cells, which are terrible, and you've got to kind of imagine these things. They're totally interior. There's no window or sunlight that comes from the outside. And the cell is probably about 7 feet. I imagine that when I lie full length, I would have an extra foot. Long, not wide. 7 feet long. And it's cinder block, cinder block, cinder block all around you. And a little bulb way up high, or else you use the fluorescent light from in the hallway out in front of it. As I said, no sunlight at all. And one half of that cell is taken up with a cot, which may be a foot and a half wide. But that's half the cell. And then the other half is just floor, except in the back against the wall is a toilet without a seat. Just the porcelain itself, that's all. That's the cell. And they brought me around to the back. And I saw Junie and I was shocked. Junie was not sitting on his cot and he was not standing up pacing as I suspect I would do. He wasn't lying on his cot, he was lying on the floor, full length on his stomach, like this. But he was not sleeping, he was awake. He had on a dirty t-shirt and pants, no shoes, barefoot. I said, Junie? And he raised his face with those doe eyes, those deep eyes, and looked at me, and then just put his face down again like that onto his hands. I said, Junie? This is Pastor, I came to talk with you. And he made a grunt, but no words. And that began our relationship in jail and my trying very hard to understand Junie and what's going on for this poor soul at this point who wouldn't get up, sit, talk, anything, just lay full length on the floor like that. I wore my collar after that, so I would have some visual. I didn't, you know, so he could be sure that this was the pastor. And I sat a long time. I would sit outside of the bars right next to his head here and talk. and talk and not ask for any kind of response from him at all. And near the end of this lecture, I'll tell you what I talked. I'll tell you the story that I told Juni. But I do want to tell you one thing that helped me to understand what story I should tell him. There came a point when I at least got him to stand up and ask whether or not he wouldn't go with me into another place where we could really be alone, because there's always people walking by, and the other cells had people in there and noise and so forth. And he agreed, and I thought, we're getting somewhere. And the guard took us down to a room that was absolutely dead, bloodless. It was about the same size as the cell, except there were no bars. There was a metal door that closed on it with a little window on the door itself. It was painted white on the inside with, again, a bloodless fluorescent light. There was one table, two chairs on either side of the table, and that was it. And we sat there, and I tried real hard to ask Juni, what's going on for you? What's happening in your head? Did you do it? Would you please describe it to me? And he began by answering questions as though he wanted to talk, but he would die mid-sentence. He'd start a sentence out and then just like that, which is so hard to try to make some communication. He would every once in a while look at me, and every once in a while I would see life come warm behind his eyes, and that I would participate in that life, and then it would glaze over. After we had been talking, or I had been talking for a little while in that room, guard came to tell us it was time to go back. And all the guard did, very common and familiar act, none of you would have any trouble with it. You would understand it so immediately it would communicate to you. But not Juni, was knock on the door. Like that. A rap. Juni went up when he heard that, as though some thunder had taken place, as though something incomprehensible. I saw him stand up, almost like a horse that rears from a snake or something like that, and throw his head back like that, and his eyes got real wide and rolled in his head, as though something terrible was happening. And that helped me understand that Juni was so confused interior that the common exterior events and signs he didn't have names for, or a means of involving them or fitting them into a life that was familiar. Do you understand what I mean then? I could see that in that single event that took place. And that helped me to understand something of the story that I should tell Juni. Something of what might help Juni. And I'm going to hold that story just for a little while. Part two, the problem. Juni is an extreme example. I know that. But I suspect that as I describe Juni to you, some of you are recognizing it, personally in your own life, or perhaps in other people whom you are close enough to know what's going on inside of them. It is a common problem, and I'm not quite sure how to title it for us, but I would say it this way. I would make a kind of a parallel. Sometimes we walk into an external land or an external community or society where we do not understand what's going on. Because of its unfamiliarity, we feel alien there. When I was young and used to walk downtown in Milwaukee and then walk among people of other races, I could feel all my invisible parts pulling into me very, very tight. Because I felt alien, and I did not know what they would do or how they would act toward me. So I'd whistle or say a joke or pretend like I belonged there, but I felt nervous. You understand? When I was even younger, I remember a time when I used to walk a mile to school. Have you heard that? I did. In my case, it's the truth. First grade, I was the oldest in the family. I walked a mile to Zohar Lutheran School. This is in Chicago. And it was a dog leg walk. I'd go up 3/4 of a mile one way, and then I would turn left and go 1/4 of a mile and come to school. One day when I was walking home, the world had changed. And it terrified me. Usually I didn't recognize. All I knew in my head was this pattern of walking. But as I would come home, usually what happened is that the houses would become familiar. The landscape would become familiar. I would begin to recognize so-and-so lives there, so-and-so lives there, and there was a kind of a coming home, a warmth, coming into my land from the strange land of school. Only this time, truth, when I walked home, nothing became familiar. And I walked and I walked, and a slow panic began to grow in me, because where I would expect there to be the familiar houses, they weren't. They were all unfamiliar. That warmth was not happening like it should. That sense of homecoming wasn't taking place. And I know I had gone too far, that I'd gone by wherever my house should be. But these are all strange houses. And I was petrified. You could see the child taking broad steps, and then slower steps, and then tiny steps, and not even wanting to go anymore. My whole world outside had changed. And do you know what I said to myself? Very common child response. I explained it this way. I said, a giant came. And a giant picked up all the houses and put them somewhere else, and brought in all the houses that I didn't know and put them here. And I was so scared to be in this land. It was a different land. Now, you know what I did. I made my turn one block too soon. That's all. I was only one block away from home, but I was coming down a parallel street, you see. And finally, I was adult enough just to retrace my tracks, go back, and then, oh, what a relief to find that there was a rational reason why the world was so unfamiliar. I had turned too soon. Well, our problem so much in this world is what I described to you exteriorly happens interiorly. We dwell within the world inside of ourselves. And sometimes as we get older and older, where we had expected to see familiar furniture, familiar houses, familiar habits, familiar behavior, familiar desires, familiar understandings, we don't. They become unfamiliar, so that even inside of us, we have entered a strange land. We become confused. Okay? This is Junie's problem, but this is the problem of many, many people that I see when they cannot name the world in which they dwell, for all kinds of reasons. It may be that the work that someone is doing or the life that someone is living does not hold an acceptable and faithful and true purpose. So it may be familiar to go to work every day and to understand what you are doing, but when anyone would press you to it, you couldn't explain why you are doing it. And if you come to the point, why am I doing this over and over again, and you cannot answer, all of a sudden, even though it's the same colors and the same events, if it has no purpose, it's strange. It's not uncommon. It's not uncommon for us today. Vince Hammerstein in my parish, another young man, comes to me and sits down in front of me, and we have a kind of a joke about what he does, but to me it's very significant. I say, okay, Vince, what's the problem? And Vince smiles at me and he throws his hands up. And what he does, he says, why? Why? He says like that, which is to imply he can't even ask the question. He can't even frame a question. In his why, I hear what? You know, it would be neat if we could clearly say, what is my life about? Or what is going on for me? But he can't make it a full sentence. Or the other question would be, why? Why am I here, and why am I doing these things, and what? Only he can't either say what or why, so he puts them together. He says, why? And in that, I get a kind of a signification of an awful lot of people who are in an unfamiliar territory, even within themselves. You see? Matthew Arnold is a poet at the turn of the century, the end of the 19th century. Don't go away from me now just because I mentioned poetry or Matthew Arnold. Matthew Arnold was very, very sensitive to what was happening at that time. He himself was not a Christian. He was not faithful, but his father had been furiously faithful. And Matthew Arnold was grieved over the fact that he could not be faithful. He found himself to be a part of a scientific age which did not see reality in spiritual terms or in mystery, or in the reality that there was some explanation outside of the things that we could touch, measure, feel, and taste, which caused reality and purpose and meaning in the things we could touch, feel, measure, and taste. And he said, what's happening to the world is that we are losing faith generally. And he was sorry about it. He writes a poem called Dover Beach, which is an extremely sad poem. And it ends like this. It's as though what he does is he draws a parallel, okay, between faith and the sea. as though he's standing on Dover Beach up on the cliffs, on those chalk cliffs, and he's looking down. And he's seeing, as the tide goes out, he's seeing the sea to recede farther and farther away. And all it leaves is stones on the shore. That's all. And as it goes, he can almost, well, he can hear the thing whispering out what he says on the naked shingles of the world. And he says, that's like faith. It makes him so sad to see it draining out of the society and the people. And all that's left are stones, hard stones. As faith goes farther and farther away, whispering. And all he's got left is a kind of a covenant which may be established between two human beings. That's all. And he says it this way. He says, ah, love. He has brought his love to the window to look at this sad thing. And he says, ah, love, let us be true to one another. That's all. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither love nor light, nor joy, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help from pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, fraught with the alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. Now, Arnold, sensitive poet that he is not just describing his own interior land, which has gone dark and looks like armies that are slapping together for no reason, struggling. He's saying this is the way the world is now. When faith drains out, our interior land is no more than stones and we can't name it anymore.
See?
It's not uncommon. But that's not just our age. Shakespeare describes almost the same thing, and it's grossly sorrowful when we can finally take away from ourselves all of the ways in which we do not ask the questions, all of the blinders that we put around ourselves. Television is an excellent blinder. It'll zonk your soul and your brains out at once. It'll look as if something is happening when nothing is happening at all, but you don't have to ask the question, is nothing happening, right? We do the same thing, oh thou workaholics. If we just keep working, we'll never stop long enough to say, does it matter? Well, in Macbeth, when Macbeth's wife has died, Lady Macbeth has died, it's near the end of the play, and everything that Macbeth had built his life hereafter upon is literally gone to dust. Not literally, but it's figuratively, it's fallen through. And when the word comes to him that his wife has died, his response is so empty. Well, it should have happened hereafter, he said. And he says, tomorrow, and he takes hold of time. And he finds it empty, like hollow rooms, like you walk through empty rooms, right? Tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day until the last syllable of recorded time. He says, life's but a walking shadow. This is terrible. Life's but a walking shadow. A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. And the implication there is that up against death, up against the assizes, up against the large and critical motions, when we are driven to answer the questions with the wholeness of our faith, where we can believe in the answers, and where these answers ought somehow or other to interpret, to define, and to give purpose to our lives, we've got nothing to say. Faithlessness. Not an uncommon problem. The reason it looks uncommon is because we have 1,000 ways of hiding it from us, from ourselves, in our busyness. We are the hollow men. We are the stuffed men. Headpiece filled with straw. Alas. T.S. Eliot. Last year, they took an x-ray of my chest. I was really into things. I was a pastor. I knew why I was. I was the father of four. I was an author. I was writing books. I was going around talking. And then they took a picture of my chest. and in there was a shadow on my lung. Well, that was all right. I was coughing some, and some blood was coming up, but I just thought it was a lung pneumonia that hadn't really cleared up, and I had driven up to Chicago from down south in Indiana, and it was snow all over the place, and my wife called me up there, and she said, "You better get home right away." I said, "Why?" And she said, "The doctor wants to do some tests." I swallowed. I said, "Okay, I'll get home right away." But, see, I could still, I was driving and a lot of snow, and I was up there working with my brother-in-law on a business thing, and I could still fill my head with all that kind of stuff, right? So we got home, and I went into the hospital for the tests. They did a bronchoscopy, which is really, bronchoscopy, you know, they stick a thing down your throat, and then that holds it open, and they can put a tube down into your lungs, and it's got a little light on the end of it. It's like a snake probing through your interior cell, and it has a little pincher on it, and they could take a biopsy of what they find down there. Only, oh, that's terrible. It holds your lung open, and when that went down into mine, it made my lungs start to bleed, and it filled up on the one side with blood. And I remember that I felt like I was drowning from the inside, and I kept going, it's a terrible sound, because I wanted to cough that up, and I couldn't. And I wanted to say something to the doctor. I wanted to say, maybe we should stop this procedure. But I had a tube in my mouth. I couldn't say anything. Roll my eyes. Like that. And when they stopped the procedure and pulled it up and I went back, then a little bit later, a doctor came in and he said, "You know, I don't know what it is. We couldn't see it, but I think that we ought to operate." If any of you have had this experience, he said, "You can go home for a few days, huh?" So I went home, and my house was like that child walking down the street, and everything was changed. This was the assizes, you see. Up against this heavy stuff, you have to ask the question. You say, is it worth anything like that? Well, you know what was it. We said, cancer? I sat in my office, and I looked around at my books on the walls and where I have my desks, my writing desk, handwriting, and my typing desk like that. And I almost cried. I said, "Oh, do I love this room? I never knew before how much I love this room. Because of what they might find." Now come the questions, you see. So that we can spend a lot of time holding the questions back. But up against certain critical events, Junie in prison, this, then the questions come. What's happening? Wow! What am I? What is the truth and the purpose and the future? All the powers around me, can I name them? It's like the gods have hidden their names from me, and they hold power over me like guards in a prison to kick me left or to kick me right, to put a cancer in me, or maybe not put a cancer in me. But what does that mean? Well, to end that real quick, so that it was a thoracotomy, and they took out the middle lobe of the lung, and it was full of scar tissue, but it was not cancerous. Okay. So I could put all the questions away, right? Back I go, this is my life. Okay, that's, if I'm beginning to give you some sense, that's the problem. And in our age, it isn't so much anymore the exterior world, although it is. It's the interior world. It's understanding ourselves and wanting very much not only to put names to what's going on, but purpose and understanding and future, and then to thread that into the interior worlds of other human beings, something which we call community. Part three. When there is such ignorance over the events that are taking place, and the inability to name, or the inability to identify a purpose behind it, what do you do? Well, now come with me backwards. This is a transition. It's kind of neat for me to raise this so that you can recognize that there's a transition going on here. Come with me backwards. I would like to posit something that I cannot prove. That is, that the same problem which I have identified here as faithlessness or ignorance or unfamiliarity and so forth and so on, existed in the days of Jesus Christ. The world is prepared for Christ to come. In the days of Rome, their gods had all become fictitious. The ways by which they used to identify their world and themselves and the compulsions in them and so forth and so on, their Jupiter, and you could go on and name all the gods, had really become jokes. When those gods became jokes, you see, gods are a way, aren't they, of interpreting your purpose and your being and the parts of you, or at least they used to be. When they became jokes, what the Romans did was to begin to believe in their state, their emperor. Rome itself became the purpose of the Romans' life. But by Jesus' day, Rome itself was gutted and hollow, amoral, purposeless. It didn't even fight its own battles anymore. It brought in mercenaries, and those mercenaries took over power and so forth and so on. Well, anyway, what did the early church do? How did they handle such situations? Now, let me make this even broader. What did the faithful do throughout all time? If you read Scripture carefully from beginning to end, you will find that there are certain propositions that are held to faithfully and absolutely, and they are not questioned. So I simply give them to you. One, all the world, every human being in the world, is in some sort of relationship to the single God that exists, to the one God. Whether the world knows it or not, this was the conviction of the prophets. When they spoke, incidentally, and when they spoke, what were they doing? They were defining what was happening. They were putting names to it. They were explaining it. They were saying, this is why, O Israel, you are suffering now. And the definition always included a relationship between divine God and all of the people. That was never questioned. Pagan or faithful, it didn't matter. They were all in some kind of a relationship with God. That's why the early prophets and the later prophets had no trouble making their oracles or their statements, not only to Israel, but also to Edom and Moab, and even to the people that dwelt between the rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, the Assyrians and the Babylonians, and the Persians and the Medes. They were absolutely convinced that God wasn't just their God, but God was all the omnis. Omnipresent, omnipowerful, omniscient. Well, all-knowing. Omniscient. So, number one, nobody escaped some kind of relationship with God. And it didn't take knowledge to establish the relationship. It took being, that's all. Two, everything that anyone did was a part of this relationship to God, whether they knew it or not. Oh, these prophets, they had a deep sense. What you chose to put on in the morning, how you rose up in the morning, whether you're going to plan on going on a hike, whether it rained or didn't rain, what kind of food you ate, the fish last night, the way in which you dropped a word for your child or for your parent or for your friend, all that kind of stuff was played out in this relationship between God and the people. It was complete. Are you with me? They would not have used these words, but I like them. They would have said that God was like the protagonist in a play. Protagonist is a Greek word. I like that word. Protagon means the first wrestler in a wrestling match. And God is the first wrestler. Now, actually, that's because the theater in Greece began with wrestling and then became acting and so forth and so on. So the protagonist is the first one that appears upon the stage later on, the principal one in relationship. Antagonist means, antagonist, means the other wrestler or the other one in this relationship which is going on. That's how Scripture viewed the world. God was the first wrestler. Almost like, if you, some of you have already thought of it, think of the brief story, we talked about it last week, between Jacob and this being that came and wrestled with him all night long. And that wrestler turned out to be God. Well, this is how the prophets saw it. They had no problem whatsoever. The antagonist was the world, or the antagonists were you and you and me, and Edom, and Jacob, and Israel, and Rome, and Syria. Everybody was in a relationship like that, okay? So we have the everybody-ness of it, and then we have time. Now, not just the Old Testament, but the New Testament. That wrestling match was not always the same. It was in a kind of a progression. Are you with me? So that it would start at a certain place, but as knowledge came, or as faith came, that wrestling match would change. Now we have if you're taking notes, what I will call the divine drama. This was the conviction that things did have meaning and purpose as they were perceived on a divine scale. That all of the people, somehow or other, were in a dramatic play. Not an empty one. This poor player that struts and frets 1 hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. But that we are always in some kind of a wrestling match or some kind of a relationship over against or else with God. See? It's neat. Oh, but if you don't understand it or you don't know it, of course you're going to live in ignorance. Then you come to the New Testament concept. And they saw that that match could begin to be defined according to certain acts. And the whole first act, which could go on perhaps for a person's whole life, was called the law. Right? Or at least that's how Paul talks in the book of Galatians. That the law was there first of all, and that was the quality of relationship between God and the people, where the people better measure up. So then what they're doing and the purpose of all of their acts is to measure up unto God's purposes. And when Paul uses the Greek term nomos, or law, he doesn't use the article in front of it. So he's not saying the law, that is to say the Old Testament law. He's just saying law, which means that it includes all of the things that make demands upon human beings. That's Act 1. But Act 2, with the coming of Jesus Christ, either into the world or into a person's life, we call grace. Now, if I can make the step that I want very much to make here. In the New Testament, when they needed very much, the New Testament era, even before they began to write it down, when they needed very much to understand these unfamiliar events that were going around them, do you know where they went? To the script for this drama. To what they called the writings. To Moses and the prophets. To the psalmists. That's how they made sense. And do you know who taught them how to do that? Well, I'm sure they did it before that, but Jesus did. Look, please, stay with me. Don't let me lose you. Do you remember when two people were walking on their way to Emmaus after Jesus had died and their heads were hanging down so low and they were so sad because they couldn't even hardly say, why? I mean, they were in that experience at that particular point. And Jesus comes and they can't recognize him, or they don't recognize him. And Jesus says, what's the matter? And they say, are you the only one in Jerusalem who doesn't know? The one whom we thought was going to save Israel. The one upon whom we hung our lives. The one by whom we found out our purpose and our name and our future died. We expected this Messiah to come and ride a palomino into the west and take out Rome and take out the priests. We thought he would be what they said through the Old Testament, a Messiah, a general, a warrior, and that would give reason for our being here at all. But he did the opposite. He came weak and he hung his head before the Sanhedrin. He didn't even struggle before the Romans and he died. Wow. Now, it's significant what Jesus did at that moment to those people who were suffering the problem. He went to the scriptures. He taught them exegesis, oh you pastors and those of you who study the script. He says, this is how you do exegesis. And he went through the Old Testament to show that the Christ had to die. What he did was he said, no! This is not just confusion or meaninglessness. There is a script for what's going on right now, and it's right before your eyes. Moses and the prophets and the Psalms. So he taught the early church what the early church did thereafter. They said, boy, we don't understand this. The guy died. And then they went back to the scriptures, and they found a script. They said, no, we do understand it. Look here in Isaiah chapters 51, 52, 53. This is the suffering servant. Now, for us, we see all those passages in the Old Testament as clear prophecies. See if I can show you something here. Prophecies work two ways, people, not just one. Most often we think of it this way. that a prophecy are words which identify or promise a future event. Okay? So you have the words, you hold them like a brief, like something dear, you put them into a treasure chest, you write them down, and you look for the event to come which the words prophesy. All right? Most often that's how we think of prophecy when it talks in terms of the future. The early church turned it around, consciously or unconsciously, I don't know, so that it went both ways. They had the events. They had the events which were confusing and hard to swallow. For example, that the Messiah should die. That was against all expectation and against all the prophecies that the people had taught them to believe. All right? They had the events which they couldn't understand. They went, so that was first. And then they went back to the scripture and found words which could explain the events. And then they said, that's prophecy. And it was. It was. So you see prophecy working both ways. See, they went back to Isaiah. I say this fast, and it requires you to hang on to it. But do you know that through the Old Testament era, nobody thought that the suffering servant was a prophecy of the Messiah? They didn't even think it was a prophecy. They thought it was a description either of the prophet or of Israel. It wasn't until Jesus had come and had died that the early church went back and said, how do we understand this? And they said, look what I found. It says, by his stripes we are healed. That he goes to the slaughter, he goes like a lamb to the slaughter, doesn't open up his mouth. And they say, that explains Jesus to us. Whole new concept of Messiah. See? Scripture was their script. Huh? In the Old Testament, nobody said that Psalm 22 was a prophecy. They thought Psalm 22 was the hard wail, the agonized cry of a human being in trouble. That psalm begins, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from hearing me, from the roaring of my soul all day long? Okay, well, in the Old Testament, isn't that neat? But the New Testament said, look, that, here's the event, Jesus on the cross, Jesus dying. And then they went back and they, well, that's a prophecy. That defines what was taking place on the cross. See? And how beautiful that was, because then they could take this impossible, unexpected thing and understand it. Okay? Scripture became their script for understanding where they were. Now, I offer it to you that it should be the same for us today, who suffer the problem, this malaise, this not understanding, this confusion of events that totally lays us flat. That also for us, Scripture may be the script so that we may understand. I'll answer that two ways. One, pause. Remember yesterday I mentioned to you about the sheep? How it wasn't until I saw sheep that I understood that phrase, I am the good shepherd, and that little experience I had. Happened while I was in graduate school, and when I was very much a part of this problem I've been trying to define for you. I had gone through the whole process of pastorate. I had gone through Concordia, Milwaukee, preparing me for the ministry, high school. 4 years college, Fort Wayne, Concordia, Fort Wayne, preparing for ministry, right? And I assumed I had faith. I think I assumed it because all the trappings of faith were around me. They were there on the outside of me, and I never questioned the inside of me. I had a dear and faithful father and mother. I had friends who were faithful. I worshiped every Sunday. In fact, I went to chapel. In fact, I had to go to chapel. So I went through that whole thing. At the end of that whole process, Keith and I are talking about this before, I went instead to graduate school, not to the seminary. My whole class went to the seminary. I peeled off, one alone, and went to graduate school in Ohio, Miami, Ohio. And what happened was, I want to say I lost faith, but I don't think it was that I lost faith. I think I discovered that I had no faith.
When I was one alone, when the trappings were all gone from around me, there was nothing inside that could do it. And I said it right. I said, it's okay. This is unconscious. I was not wise. I was not philosophical. I said, it's okay. You don't need God. I said, I need forgiveness because I am constantly feeling embarrassed and humiliated and ashamed over the things that I do. So I knew I needed forgiveness. But it seemed to me that I didn't sin against God. Why? I had never met God. I sinned against other people. And if I had had the gut to go to the people and ask for their forgiveness, that would be my religion, my mother, my friends, my brothers and sisters. Only what happened then, and I'm going to conflate this very, very much, is that I began to discover a new emotion, a new feeling that I never had before this way. I began to be lonely. I'd been lonely before, but any other time before in my life when I had been lonely, I could perceive an end coming. If I was lonely in the summer, I'd wait for school. That would heal my loneliness. Or if I was lonely away from home at school, I'd wait for the summer or for vacation. That would heal my loneliness. But now I was an adult, don't you see? Now I had entered life. And if I was lonely now, where is the ending going to be, huh? So then it was a cosmic loneliness. Now this is the problem as I discovered it. I couldn't explain it to other people because I had no words. On the surface level, I was friendly and smiled and wrote my papers and so forth and so on. But underneath, there was always that agonizing lump in me that couldn't take a name, that made life so difficult. It drained all my attention. I found that I had a prayer going in the back of my mind, always. Always there was this prayer. I didn't have to consciously pray it, because if I stood still long enough, there it was. And it was just two words. Over and over again, I was saying, love me, love me, love me, love me. I didn't hear an answer, but the prayer was still there. Question without an answer. And I came to the point where I had to write papers. I had four papers to do and two exams to take. And I had 2 weeks left, and I couldn't do it. I'm really shortening this a great deal. That's when I went, I thought I had figured the whole thing out. I would do it on my own. I went to the dean of the Department of Graduate Studies, and I went into, his name was Spiro Peterson, a dear man, short man, dear man, who listened to me. I said, I had a fellowship, you see, and I said, can I not write these papers, and can I skip the exam? Can I have 3 months alone before I take this stuff and still keep my fellowship? And Peterson said, what's the problem? And I said, I think the problem is with God. I was more honest than I had expected to be. And he said, no. And now I know why he was a dear man, because he closed the door because I started to cry. All by which I had defined myself. At this point, I had used my intellect to define myself, right? My ability in education, that's what took the place of God. My own talents, that's how I'd named. All that came tumbling down. I didn't have the resources to handle it. When I was done crying, that's when I walked out into the country. And that's when I saw the sheep. And that's when I wanted to run at those weak sheep, you see. And that's when the shepherd, the farmer, walked out and clucked in and clucked his tongue like that. And when I saw that, now I can tell you, here was my script, people. Here was the script, and I suddenly began to understand what had been happening for me. I was the antagonist. I had all along been wrestling with God, with a denial of the presence of God, with a damning of the relationship between God and me, and that had caused me, yes, a cosmic loneliness. I had made the separation, not God. And finally, and it's like I had become my God. I was going to live by my intellect, by my fond intelligence, by getting A's and teaching classes, and I didn't even go to classes after a while. And in that instant, suddenly the script was Good Shepherd and Sheep. Suddenly the script was Psalm 23. Suddenly the script said, you are a sheep, you dummy. You are not able to live for yourself. You are not able to feed yourself. You cannot fight the wolves on your own. It must be a shepherd. And that little part of John 10 rose up and defined for me what I had been going through all along. It named it, and it said, all along the shepherd has been clucking. All along the shepherd has been there saying, I know your name, but you're not listening to me. The only way you can listen to me, you stupid Walt, is to acknowledge that you are a sheep, that you are empty, that you are unable, that you cannot make it. Die that death to yourself. You see, all of a sudden, wham, this makes sense to me. Die that death to yourself. Do not be your own God. Quit. Just quit. And I will be the shepherd I have always wanted to be. Now that for me, we can't make those experiences happen. And it wasn't loud. You know, I didn't roll across the ground or the Spirit blow me over. But I went back to my apartment and I said, okay, I am the sheep. I will seek nothing out of myself anymore. I won't even lay the law against myself. You understand? Act 2. I will not demand out of myself the keeping of these papers. I'll tell you what, I'll just do. And if anything comes out of it, why, Lord, it is yours, because now I know my hollowness and my absolute emptiness. And so without the pressure of law on me anymore, without the pressure, don't you understand, of saving myself or creating myself by writing papers, by making myself important by writing papers, without that pressure anymore, I wrote 4 papers. And I passed my test. In 2 weeks, but I didn't. It was finally the recognition that I was nothing that allowed God to be something, that I might peacefully go about the work that God had laid before me, and God could perform the work. I had a script. I understood. You see, we can do the same thing. We go back to Scripture for the script of what is in fact happening around us. And now Junie. I told Junie a story over and over and over again. I said, there was a man who had 2 sons. That's what I said. And the younger of the sons asked his father for his inheritance. I said, now, Junie, you've got to understand this story. In those days, when the younger son asked for inheritance, that was unusual. It meant that the younger son no longer wanted to depend upon his father, okay? To say, I'm not a part of this family anymore. I'm apart from it. You got to understand that, Junie. The second thing is, though, when this younger son took his inheritance, which probably meant land, and converted it to money, which he could take somewhere else, that was something you never did until your father was dead. Because the father, even when he gave the inheritance to his son, had rights of interest on that inheritance. As soon as you converted it into money, there was no interest anymore. The father could no longer receive the money from it. I said, Junie, do you understand that when the second son converted that inheritance into money and left, what the son was saying to the father in as much as words was, you're as good as dead to me. You're dead man to me. I'm going to live my own life now. I said, Junie, you've got to understand this story. The inheritance that we're talking about isn't land. It's your body. It's your talents. It is those luminous eyes that you have. It's your ability to cook. It's a person's being. And there comes a point in this story where we who were created by God take all these things, demand all these things from God. We say, I'm going to live independent now. And more than that, we translate these talents to things that become our gods. We say, you, O creator of mine, you're as good as dead to me. And we feel free because no longer do we have to measure up to this individual, this being, this God that made us. So in freedom we go into our far country. And that doesn't have to be, you understand, it doesn't have to mean that we literally, physically go into the Navy or go away. It means that we choose a whole other way of life. And in that way of life, we're the kings and we're the queens. And we spend our talents and those eyes and this body precisely as we want to, because they're ours now. They don't belong to anybody else. You understand? Of course, I didn't shout at Junie, right? But you're a bunch of people, so I can shout at you. The trouble being for this second son, that when the son left, the father didn't realize, but cut off relationship to the source of life. See? So long as the son was with the father, then life could come infinite. without end to the Son. But when the Son said, go by to the Father and you're as good as dead to me, he only had as much life as he could carry in his hands. And that's limited, and there is an end to it. There's only so much Walt here, about 6 foot one. Only so much Junie lying there, about 6 foot four. That's all. So, when the Son goes into a far country all by himself, he spends what he has in loose living. He fooled around, I don't know, that's what his older brother thought. Prodigal, he spent it. Spent it all. That became the purpose of his life, wasn't it, anymore? Not to accumulate or to get, but to get rid of and to spend. So he got friends, maybe, I don't know. But you see, no longer a part of the source of life. Now all you spend, you lose. It isn't replenished. Because we're not creator. We're not parent of ourselves anymore. Well, when it was all spent, here comes the second thing, and that is, you discovered this, Junie, maybe, I don't know, but it's in the story. The second son found out that the world doesn't love him. The world is just the world. It goes on its own way. And sometimes the world turns over in bed and whops you with the back of its hand, and it doesn't even know what it's doing. Here came a famine. I don't know, maybe it was an economic famine. What I mean to say is, maybe it wasn't the lack of rain, maybe it was governmental policies changing. I don't know. Lost a job, huh? The world didn't love the second son, and that was terrible. Because now the second son began to understand the loneliness. Now all the second son was doing was trying to stay alive, body, soul, together. Not even meaning, just life. Maybe you understand that, Junie. And the famine got so bad that the son took a job which was contemptible. Like rolling people, huh? So he didn't even want to do it. He was a Jew and he was in a pig pen, right? Not only was he not eating pork, he was feeding pork for other people to eat. Terrible place to be. And he wished that he could have the pods that the pigs ate, and no man, no one would give him even to eat. That's loneliness. Now, Junie, I got to tell you this real quick. Something's going on back home this entire time. The servant said, thank God that kid is gone. It's hard to have around anyway. But the father kept going up on the roof of the house. See, the servants were fair. They knew right and wrong. They knew reward and punishment and discipline. That's why they said, thank God the kid is gone. They were holding to the law, right? But the father kept going up on the roof of the house, that old man, and he kept looking out to the city, to the streets, to the place where the second son had gone, because the father was not fair. The father was merciful. He said, Junie, hang on to that. That father was always pacing, always what his heart would go out, and he wept to say, what's happening to my son? Because surely the father knew what would happen to his son when his resources had been cut off, even if the son himself had cut him off. And see, wasn't it the love of the father anyway in the first place that allowed the son to have it? The problem in this story, Junie, is not that the father doesn't love the son. The problem is that the son doesn't understand what love is. So there is that father who is not fair, which would be lawful, but is merciful. Watch. Now, as the story goes on, while this son is at the bottom, what is it? How do they say that I'm so far down? Down looks like up to me. The son has gotten into a position where there is absolutely nothing the son can do anymore to save himself, to name himself, to do anything. He's at the very bottom. I say, Junie, that looks terrible, doesn't it? How does it feel? But then I say, but Junie, that's maybe the best place to be in this story. If the son had stayed home, maybe he never would have known what love is. But when the son gets to the point where he can do absolutely nothing, and when, as it says in the text, the script, and he came to himself, then there's the possibility of new discovery. Well, that's how my story says it. It says, while he was sitting there, he came to himself. It's like he woke up. It's like he was born. It was like he came to be what he should have been all along. And he said, ha, I... Get these words, Junie. They're terrible and they're beautiful. They're terrible because they mean your death. They're beautiful because they can mean your life. He said, I am
not worthy. Nothing in me, nothing in me anymore to be called my father's. I know what I'll do. It's the only thing I got left. I'll get up and I'll go home and I will say, confession, eh? I'll say, Father, I have sinned against heaven and you. Look, I'm not worthy to be your son. Just let me be one of your servants. I won't ask for sonship. That's what the kid said, eh? And think how terrible that would be. That means going back and gainsaying everything that you did. It means flushing your life down the toilet, goodbye. It means everything that you thought was good, worthy, nameable, saying nuts to it. It isn't. Confession is the death is coming to yourself. Confession is overtly announcing the death to somebody else. And so that's what happened in my story. Junie, now catch this. The guy got up out of that pig pen, didn't do anything for himself, dragged himself on the way home. Now you remember that the father was up on the roof looking back and forth again and again. The servants were all whispering and saying, what is wrong with the old man? He keeps looking for that renegade son of his. The son's getting what he deserves, which he was. But the father was not fair. The father was merciful. So when he sees this little dot of the figure out on the horizon, Junie, here comes the neat part of my story. The father comes down off the roof. And now this is very embarrassing for old folks to do. Especially the word dramon, which is in Greek, which means that he pulled up his skirt. And he ran out to that son. Hard as he could, because he was not fair. He was merciful. Now the son sees him coming, and as the father comes, the son throws up his hands. He's going to have his confession. He's going to show what he has learned. He has learned zero. He has learned nothing. He has learned that he is worthless, that he is nothing. And he's going to say it. He says, Father, wait, wait, before you beat me. I am not worthy. I have sinned against heaven. I have sinned before you. Look, I just want to be. And then the father throws his hand over his mouth like that. Shush, shush, he says, I don't want to hear that. And throws his arms around his and squeezes him, something that the son knows to the root of his soul he does not deserve. Ha! Love. For the first time, maybe the son is beginning to understand what love is, that it is not fair. It is merciful, Junie. And that son doesn't know what to say. Well, he doesn't have to say anything. He doesn't even have to be in this relationship because all the being will come out of the father who's going to put his son back together again and recreate him. Father has tears in his eyes and he says to the servants, you know, all those guys who said he deserves what he is, he sucks them into mercy too. They can't help it. He says, run, run, go get shoes. Go get shoes for my son. And they come and they say, you know what shoes mean? Shoes mean that this is an honored guest. This kid. I told you, spit. And so they put shoes on the feet of the son. And that's saying, guest, you see what's happening? The creating father, the bearing father, is recreating and rebearing and reborning this kid again. And he doesn't deserve it. He can just have a mouth open like they sing. Now he's saying, why? But there's a fullness to this question. He says, why are you doing this to me? But the father says, run, go get my ring. It's on the bureau. It's the ring that I give to the one who is truly my son. Signet ring. It means that he has my authority and my inheritance and my blessing. Go get it. And they bring it. And he puts it on the son's finger, saying, you are my son. You are not worthy. Right. But you are my son. Anyway. And then he does something that they almost never did. It's just like Holden. They didn't eat meat much. But when they did, it was a glorious education. He says, run and kill that calf. I've been saving it for something like this. And let's have a party. I said, Junie, here's how it ends. And with these words at the end of the story, they're not images, they're not metaphor, they're not symbols, they are facts, absolute facts. Because the father says with tears on his face, he says, because this, my son, was lost. That doesn't mean lost to me, it means lost to himself, it means lost in the world, and he's found. And he says, this, my son, was dead. Now look at Junie. Look how I name for you what's happening. And he said, but he is alive again. Well, I told that story over and over to Junie. Not so dramatically, okay? I just sat and I told it quietly. Over and over I told that story to Junie.
Before he was sent up, he was sent to state prison. He called me up. When you call from jail, you have to call Colette. You're not nobody in jail. Right? You're nothing. You are not worthy. You are empty. But the Father, not fair. Guards are fair. Father merciful. He called me up at home, and Fan took the call at first and said, "It's Junie." See, she had to say, "Yes, you will accept the charge." Long distance, I thought, but it was Junie in jail. I picked up the phone and I said, "Hello." No answer. I heard a kind of a breathing. I said, "Hello, Junie, is that you?" No answer. Well, I was going to hang up. I said, "Junie?" And then he said, "Well, I think I love you." And he hung up. Thank you.